Hey everyone, Chet Cemetery is back. Today I'm joined by a brand new guest, Bryant Burnett, and we are talking about The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, which is technically a prequel to Rose Red, but it came out after Rose Red. But Bryant, how are you doing today?
I'm good.
Doing
how are you?
Pretty well over here. I am working my way through a few of the Dark Tower books. You know, I have three back to back to back here to read. I am hoping to finish Wolves of the Callow by the time everyone is hearing this, maybe even Song of Susanna. So lots of reading to do on my end as usual. But this movie was a nice quick break from that, I guess.
It was a break, I'm sure. How nice.
Yeah. Well, before we dive into the movie, do you want to quickly let our listeners know how you ended up being a Stephen King fan?
Yeah, it's kind of an unusual story. I'll be as brief as I can with it. I was a big Arnold Schwarzenegger fan when I was a teenager.
I know where this is going.
Yeah, I may be the only person that became a Stephen King fan indirectly because of The Running Game. Because here's what happened. I read the novel because my mom wouldn't let me go see the movie. My dad bought the book for me, so I read it and enjoyed it. Didn't think anything more of it. But then a few years later, when the expanded version of The Stand came out, my dad read a review of it, was just telling me about it, and I remembered, oh yeah, that's the guy that wrote that Running Man book. So I went and got a copy of The Stand and read it, and have been reading Stephen King ever since.
Yeah, that seems to be how it happens for a lot of people. They read something when they're younger, maybe a little too young for certain Stephen King books, but then they just end up diving in and really finding themselves diving deep into his bibliography. And of course, you always have the TV shows and movie adaptations. And like I said, today we're talking about The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, which it's funny when things like this happen because he wrote Rose Red specifically for TV, which he's done a few times now. You know, he has Storm of the Century, The Golden Years, and the fact that someone was like, oh, let's take this story that they basically already told in Rose Red, but make an entire movie out of it, and it's easier to find this one than it is Rose Red. It's super weird.
That is really strange. I didn't actually realize until listening to your podcast on Rose Red that was that difficult to find. I bought the DVD when it came out 100 years ago or whatever that was, and I never thought about it again. It kind of blows my mind to think that that's not widely
available.
Yeah,
I was like, why can't I just rent this digitally on iTunes or Amazon or wherever? And with The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, I was just like, click Amazon, rent it. Standard definition, but that's what you get when something isn't super popular and does not get updated for HD or anything. And I was more than happy to pay the $2.99 to watch it, even though it wasn't exactly my favorite thing by a long shot. I just thought that the cast was interesting. I will give them that. But the story, I was kind of like, we know how this ends as soon as it begins. If you've seen Rose Red anyway, if you're someone who happens to have not seen Rose Red and you watch this first, that makes more sense. But as someone who is watching and reading everything chronologically, it was an interesting choice that they did this.
Yeah, it's, I assume that you know that there was a novel version of this that came out around the same time Rose Red did. It came out like maybe a month in advance.
But also not written by King, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes, it was written by a guy named Ridley Pearson, who was, I guess you'd say, a contemporary of his. But when it was released, there were tons of people who speculated that, oh, well, it must have been written by Stephen King because, you know, the authorship didn't come out for months. So there were so many people that thought, oh, well, it must be a King novel that it actually became a number one bestseller. So my assumption is that the movie must have been made as a result as much of anything else as because of that. Because, you know, number one bestseller in its own right. And then Rose Red did pretty well in the ratings. That being the case, it's kind of weird to me that they didn't do a more full miniseries based on the novel, because really all you've got is kind of just, it's almost nothing, to be honest. The novel isn't the greatest thing ever written, but there is more to it. They could have easily milked it for at least one more night, if not two. And in all honesty, I'm kind of glad they didn't, but they could have. It just doesn't make sense to me that they decided to, you know, try to spin the property off, but then did this little with it. Those things just don't line up.
Yeah, I think, well, first we'll touch on the cast real quick. You have Lisa Brenner as Ellen, Stephen Brand as John Rimbauer, Kate Burden as Connie Posey, and then Brad Greenquist as Doug Posey and Deirdre Quinn as Fanny, Cy Chin as Madame Lou. Those are kind of your main characters you see. And then you have Sukina, and the same actress plays her in Rose Red and The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer. So she's kind of the connection as far as the characters go. I'm not going to even attempt to pronounce the actress's name because I know I will completely butcher it. But what I found most interesting about this is that Brad Greenquist was Victor Pascal in the original Pet Sematary, and he returned in the most random King movie ever, I think. Well, not maybe not ever, but, you know, this is pretty random.
He had had a tiny role in Golden Years also, so this wasn't his first time back. I don't know why, but I really like that guy. Maybe it's just my fondness for Pet Sematary peeking through. But I thought he was pretty good in this.
He was. And I think the story is where this really falls apart, because you do have good performances. My problem with the story was that we saw almost the whole thing in flashbacks in Rose Red already. So I was like, okay, what are you hitting me with that's new? And it was just kind of like a, let's fill in the blanks with stuff that's obvious and not really too exciting.
Not even that, they also get the details wrong. For example, and I'm sure you noticed this, one example is in the scene where Brad Greenquist's character commits suicide. He does it very differently in Rose Red. And in the novel, it lines up with Rose Red. The same guy who wrote the novel wrote the screenplay for The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, the movie, somehow completely changes the way Douglas Posey commits suicide. Huh? I can't make sense of that.
Yeah, when I was watching it, I was like, this doesn't seem right. And it just felt like, because we had that visual aspect with the flashbacks in Rose Red, it's kind of like, how do you get this wrong? Like, it's right there for you.
I don't know. And it happens multiple times.
Yeah. It's a very good thing that this was only 89 minutes.
Yeah, it feels considerably longer. What's your opinion of Lisa Brenner and Stephen Brand compared to the people that play those characters in Rose Red?
I think at times they were a little more over the top than I was expecting, but I also expect that a lot with certain Stephen King adaptations, especially ones where I'm kind of feeling iffy about them to begin with. So for me, I thought they played off the tension well, but there was something about their chemistry every other time when tensions weren't high that just felt a little off.
Yeah, and I think to some extent that's baked into the material, because I guess the idea is that, you know, these are two people that have nothing in common and really shouldn't be together, but because of the way society was back then, they sort of get forced together thanks to John's lust, and, you know, everyone is miserable for the rest of their lives as a result. So, you know, I get that that's the point. I don't know that the movie does anything with that point. It's just, it feels flat rather than meaningful.
Yeah, earlier you mentioned that they probably could have made this a 2 or 3 night event. And I think the way that would have worked best is if they dove into the house more, because it's very obvious when you watch Rose Red that this is a house inspired by the Winchester Mystery House in California, which is where I'm from and I have been there. So you really get this similar backstory to where there's construction all the time. You know, they're building 24/7. That's straight out of Winchester House. And it just feels so disappointing that they don't dive into that more in this. All they really focus on is the tower.
Yeah. I actually, when I was watching it, I made a note of that because there's the seance scene where Madame Lou, the mystic, you know, repeats, "Build me to the heavens and life never stops." Like she's channeling Rose Red. And then the movie just completely forgets about that until, like you say, they mention the tower.
Yeah.
And I was almost like, oh, wait, yeah, that's a thing. And there is more of it in the novel. Still probably not as much as there should be, but one of the ways that the novel is more expansive is it really goes into some detail early on to make you feel that Ellen is almost like a Carrie White type figure and just doesn't really understand what that means.
Yeah.
So that there's some sort of a relation between her psychic abilities and whatever it is that powers Rose Red. And that's never really explained in the novel either, but it's definitely not explained in the movie.
No, and you see so much of the house in Rose Red to not even see, you know, the mirrored library being constructed or something just feels so disappointing because John goes around and he mentions the construction multiple times, but you never see or hear it until, again, the tower.
Yeah, it's really weird. My only guess on that is that they must have just not had the sets from Rose Red anymore and didn't want to spend the money to remake them. Beyond that, I don't know. It's almost as if it's not even really a prequel. It just feels like something else. But yeah, they really don't capitalize on Rose Red itself at all. It doesn't even feel like the same place.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, Stephen King did have an executive producer credit on this. I don't know how much he was necessarily involved with that credit, but it could simply be because it was based off of Rose Red, he automatically got that credit. But it just felt like there was so much missing out of this story. And I love, love, love a good haunted house story. When you take something like The Haunting of Hill House, for example, they really take their time not only diving into the characters, but diving into Hill House. And that's what makes that season of the show work. And we have, you know, The Haunting of Bly Manor coming up soon, too. And I think Mike Flanagan is someone who gets that. And it felt like Ridley Pearson maybe didn't get that.
His interest in the novel seemed to be more in the characters. Okay. And the novel is okay. It's probably worth a read at some point if you are a real Rose
Track
Red
it down.
Fan. Yeah, don't get your expectations up. C+, B-, something like that. But worth reading. But in making the translation to television movie, yeah, it just doesn't work. There are a few scenes here and there that I like, but overall it's just kind of there.
Yeah, and I had done some reading up on where the actual mansion is that this takes place, and it is in the Seattle area, which is why this takes place there. But it really felt like they just didn't want to use the house as a character as much as they should have, because I think haunted house stories work best when you take the house and you give it character. Not necessarily saying it has like feelings and stuff, but there's just something about the house to where you know at all times, okay, you know, in Rose Red, you knew that the hallways could change at any given moment, the layout of the house could change. That doesn't happen in this.
Yeah, it's so weird. But, you know, Rose Red is called Rose Red. It's not called, you know, the Joyce Reardon story or The Wrath of Annie or whatever you would think of. It's called Rose Red. And Rose Red itself is almost an afterthought in the prequel about it, which, I don't know. It's just very strange.
Also, the fact that this is called The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, and we don't see too much of the diary for quite a while, I feel like that didn't really come into play until almost halfway through.
Yeah, they should have titled it something else. The novel is titled that because, you know, it takes the form of diary entries. Right. That's how the story is told. So it makes complete sense for the novel. But what makes sense in a novel isn't necessarily what makes sense for a movie. And I got to figure that there are, you know, lots of people that watched it that were like, wait, why was that called The Diary of Ellen Rembauer? She writes in it like three times.
I don't want to go completely negative on this, so I want to give some credit where credit is due. They did have a good cast, and while chemistry wasn't always right on set necessarily or in the scenes, they did get, I think, familiar enough names for the time to where people probably were interested in this. And I do think that what we do see of the house was done really well because, like you said, we don't know if they didn't have the rose red sets or not, but what we did see of the house, like the big opening and the tower in the attic, that all looked pretty much the same from what I recall from watching Rose Red.
Yeah, the exteriors for sure.
Yeah.
And I think there may be one or two places that they did film inside Thornwood Castle, I think is what
that
it's called.
That sounds right.
So, you know, there are things in it that do work. And I don't think anybody in the cast is bad. There are a few people that I think are, you know, maybe not cast as well as they could have been for the role that they're playing, but nobody's bad.
No, and I think the only scene that maybe didn't age well was when they went on their sort of honeymoon world trip, where have you, and it's where we first see Sukina, and you kind of just have this weird situation where John is very clearly having fun, Ellen very clearly is not, and it just felt like, I don't know if it was necessarily cultural appropriation on purpose, but it was just a scene that didn't really age super well.
Yeah, I see what you're saying with that, and I agree. There is more to it in the novel, but really all it amounts to is that John is a sex addict, and, you know, not in those terms, but that's what he is. And for him, that's a big part of the reason why he wants to travel the globe is to, you know, it's kind of like how if you go to Epcot, you want to eat at all the restaurants at the World Showcase. It's not the greatest analogy known to man, but it's pretty close. And Ellen, of course, is skeeved out by that, as anyone would be. There's enough interest there that if they had really committed to telling that story, they probably could have done something interesting with it. They just didn't. They just threw that one scene in there. And
it was such a stark difference from the tone of everything else in the movie that you're like, oh, okay, I guess we needed this for the purpose of them being on their honeymoon to see where they went. But you don't really need it to let us know how much of a jerk John is. You know, we get that plenty throughout the movie.
Yeah, the only real function that it serves is to show how Sukina became part of the gang. But you probably could have figured out some other way of doing that as well.
Yeah, I mean, in Rose Red, it's just a flashback to Sukina taking care of Ellen, if I'm not mistaken. That scene looked very familiar, at least. I think that's where most of my issues lie with this. It's like we got so many flashback scenes or like little clips here and there in Rose Red, whether it was like visions or flashbacks or the ghosts sort of reenacting things. You know how the story ends when this movie begins, and it just felt like it didn't have enough of a purpose to bolster any of the story from Rose Red.
Yeah, there's really no reason for it to exist, is there? That's kind of what it comes down to. It doesn't do anything, and that's a trap that prequels can fall into. This one definitely fell into
it. I certainly think this should have focused more on the house, and like I said, I didn't want to be completely negative about this, so do you have anything else that you particularly enjoyed about this?
Yeah, actually I do. I really like the one scene where April, the scene that leads up to her disappearance, where she's kind of playing in the bed sheets that are on the clotheslines, which, you know, is kind of reminiscent of the miniseries version of It, which is, you know, I guess cool in its own right. But I really like that shot where she's looking at the shadow of Douglas Posey on the other side of one of the sheets, and she looks down and the shadow just ends at the bottom of the sheet and there's nothing there.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Is that enough to recommend this movie? No, but you know, if you're somehow held at gunpoint and forced to watch this movie, that's something to look forward to. But yeah, I don't hate it. It's just one of those things that I'll watch every 10 years or so and say, okay, well, yeah, I remember that. That's a thing.
One character we haven't mentioned yet is Fanny. And I think her character falls a little flat because she really just comes off as like the jealous ex. And I think they could have done a little more with her character before she disappears into the globe.
Yeah, I think she's maybe a couple of different characters that have sort of been combined into one. But yeah, in the movie, she's almost like a cartoon or something. She's so manipulative and I don't want to say evil. Evil's the wrong word, but just stereotypical bad girl, I guess, that you almost can't take her seriously. And it almost seems like nobody in high society would even interact with
her. I also just wanted to know more about the globe.
Yeah, that's one of those things. It's mentioned in the novel. It's only like one sentence, and then they kind of focused on that more than it seems like they should have. It's almost like they draw too much attention to it in the movie. And I don't know if that was some kind of practical consideration, or maybe it's a symbol of the journey that Ellen and John took around the world that ruined everything. I don't know, but it's kind of a strange little device. I don't know if I think it works.
Yeah, because you're under the impression that the house is able to do things, but the globe is just an object in the house. So then it's like, okay, is it anything in the house that is going to respond to whatever's happening? Because you would think, like in Rose Red, for instance, we saw how the mirrored floor in the library started shifting. And that made sense because it was a physical part of the house. But you have to imagine this globe didn't just exist in the house when they built it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guarantee you somebody watched this and thought that it was a movie that was just about an evil haunted globe.
Probably.
Didn't even understand that everything else was supposed to be just as evil or haunted or whatever. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point.
I like it when these things have rules to them, and this one didn't seem to have any rules, which just makes it kind of confusing, because in Rose Red, you kind of figured out what the rules were. The house could shift, and the house could basically have a dead double of the person. You know, the house would take the person, but still project that person out into the house and on the property. But you couldn't really imagine those things existing outside of the property. And this globe is just a globe.
Right, yeah. What happens if you take it to, you know, Tuscaloosa, Alabama? What's going to happen if you set it down there? Is it going to suck people up?
Or is the house not going to let you take it out of the house? Like, what's going on here? And I think it would have worked better if it had just been, you know, maybe a closet in the house that sort of sucked people in instead of this random object.
Yeah, I agree. I hadn't really focused on that. That's a good point.
And like you said, I wouldn't say this was horrible. I just think within the context of Stephen King's Rose Red, we didn't really need it. I think you could watch this on its own or possibly before you watch Rose Red and be like, okay, you know, there's this love story where things go wrong. He built her this entire house and unequivocally says it's your house, you know, but at the same time, during the seance, he was like, I will not tolerate this in my house. And you're kind of like, but it's not really your house. It is, but it isn't.
Yeah, the story has some themes in it that kind of deal with women being viewed as property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Rembauer is a businessman, and he kind of treats everybody as though they're some business transaction.
Yeah.
He treats Douglas Posey that way. He treats his wife almost as though he's purchasing her. And Ridley Pearson, once again, explores more of that in the novel. He just, I guess he wasn't quite cut out to write a screenplay. I don't know if that's something he had ever done before or since, but all of that just fails to come across in the movie. And like you say, even if it did, it honestly doesn't add much of anything to Rose Red, which is, in some ways, its primary function.
Yeah, I think this is one of those things that you can certainly skip if you just want to watch Rose Red, because I do think Rose Red has a slightly better cast and you have more personalities that you're dealing with. In this, you really have a few main characters, you know, Doug and his wife come and go, and they aren't really the sole focus of the story, but they felt like they were thrown in there because of Rose Red showing you Doug's death in the first place. So you have to know how we get to that point, who this man is, and why he decides to commit suicide in someone else's house.
Yeah. One of the things that occurred to me while watching this, and I'm sorry, I'm going to take us on a very brief Rose Red tangent. I don't think they really cast Ellen correctly in either version.
Okay.
I don't dislike either one of them. I just don't, to me, it doesn't feel like they got her character right. And some of that you may have to blame Stephen King. I don't know. But to me, doesn't it seem like she should be kind of terrifying every time you see her, even when she's just a normal human woman? Doesn't it seem like she should be a little bit terrifying?
Yeah, it feels like there are maybe a few too many times where she looks like she feels helpless. And because of her connection to the house, you think that would be empowering her.
Yeah, yeah. I don't, especially in the prequel, I just don't think they quite got that mix right. I while rewatching this, I kept thinking, and I hate to do this because it's unfair, but I can't help it either, but I kept thinking, what would this be like if Eva Green had played this role? There's something I could get on board with.
It's sometimes fun to talk about those what-if casting moments, though, because with a lot of Stephen King adaptations, I don't want to say a lot, but with some, you have things go wrong. Like, there was a time where Steven Spielberg was tied to a Stephen King adaptation and he didn't end up being the one doing it. Same with George Romero. And you're always just kind of like, well, what if these guys got their hands on these things and we would have had a much different outcome?
You may have read this story before. You haven't gotten to it in your chronology. There's a short story called U.R.
Right.
And are you familiar with this at all?
I actually just heard about this one semi-recently. I, like you said, haven't read it just yet in my chronological reading here. There are a few things coming up that I have read before, but for the most part, everything that I'll be reading between, you know, the Fifth Dark Tower book and I think, like, End of Watch will be completely new for me.
Gotcha. Well, I don't want to give too much away about that story, but it's about a Kindle that a guy gets accidentally. He buys a Kindle, but they send him one that can access books from other dimensions. So, you know, he's looking for something to read, and he sees all these books by, say, Ernest Hemingway that he knows doesn't exist, but he can read them. So ever since I read that story, me and another King reading friend of mine, we always talk about if only we could get an Kindle and use it to watch the George Romero movie of The Stand, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, the alternate reality where Hugh Jackman played James Bond or something like that. And that would be a very cool thing to have.
Yeah. Well, Bryant, I don't know if I have too much more to say about this movie, but do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I don't. You know, like we've said, it's not the worst thing that was ever made. It just doesn't really justify its own existence.
Yeah, I gave it a 2 out of 5 because I did like some of the performances and some of the things they did and how they kept Sukina the same actress for both. That really tied things together nicer, even though there are a lot of things you and I have both said we would have enjoyed better if they dove into the house more and how that works. And I think just having that one character even be the through line, it helps when you're trying to make these connections.
Yeah, I'd say two out of five is probably about right. Nothing special, but definitely not Children of the Corn quality.
Yeah, there was still a decent production value. The sets looked pretty good, even though we maybe didn't get as much of the house as we would have liked again. But Bryant, thank you so much for rewatching this and coming on to talk about it. I know you said you probably only watch it once every 10 years, but I still appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I got to figure, you know, this is my only opportunity in the entirety of my life to actually talk about The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer with another human being. You got to jump on that opportunity when it presents itself.
We might be the only two who have seen it. Who knows?
It's entirely possible. But yeah, it's my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.